It's that time. Lock and load. The Michael Vary Show is on the air.
President Donald J. Trump has been indicted. That news, not yet official, but coming from enough sources that it is believed to be true, hit the press wires at about 5:30 p.m. Eastern time today. To my knowledge, and we are watching everywhere we can watch, news wires, every source we have, there is not an official statement. The Manhattan District Attorney, Fat Alvin Bragg, has not issued a statement. President Trump has not issued a statement. There is nothing coming from the court system as of what I'm saying right now, as of this moment, that says President Trump has been indicted. But enough people are going with it based on sources close enough to the matter that the deed is done. What I suspect happened is that they held the indictment until past press time so that they wouldn't have to take questions today. And my guess is they waited for the grand jury to exit the building and get out of the space until they let this hit. This type of action being released to the press after 5 p.m. Eastern, where this is happening. Remember, this is in Manhattan. This is in downtown New York. Suggests that they wanted to get it in the public domain and get the heck out of there for a lot of different reasons, for many, many different reasons. They were suggesting there would be a physical threat in New York. I don't believe that will be the case. They will make a big show of the barricades and the police force and all that. I think there will probably be some people who will carry American flags, maybe some bullhorns saying this is bull crap. I am disappointed. I love this country. And this is a Rubicon that once crossed cannot be undone. This is wrong on multiple levels, whatever you may think of Donald Trump, whatever anyone may think of Donald Trump. This is Trump delusion syndrome having reached an absolute epidemic. It has exploded among these people. The exact charges have not been released and are not expected to be known tonight. The judge has not spoken on the issue. It is sort of standard in this particular court, so I'm told. I've never practiced there, that they will not speak to the issue until the defendant makes his initial appearance in court. And from what I understand from last week, when some of these things were being worked out, it was expected it would come down last Wednesday, and that the exchange of President Trump and the role of the Secret Service and how that would work would have occurred on Monday of this week. That has now obviously been delayed by a week and a day. Here we are Thursday evening, and the news has come down. This will dominate the news cycle tomorrow. The expectation is that early next week that will occur. The charge that is expected, the actual charge is not clear because this is a state court, so it will have to be a state law. And that's one of the many reasons this is a very weak case. This relates to a payment made to Stormy Daniels for $130,000 from the Trump Organization. That's not in doubt. That occurred a week or so before the November 2016 election. That's not in doubt. Who authorized that payment is in doubt. If Trump is not the person who authorized it, whether you like it or not, whether anyone likes it or not, Trump's not responsible. It could be his organization. It could be his lawyer, Michael Cohen, who will be a key witness in this case and who is a terrible witness. Any court observer related to this case will tell you that Cohen is a horrible witness. Cohen has been making the circuit. He has been declaring that he's going to get vengeance on Donald Trump. He's angry at Donald Trump. He's going to make every accusation possible. The problem is that when Cohen cut his deal, he was supposed to be given leniency for helping uncover a number of other crimes, including the medallion crime related to the limo and taxi business in New York that his father-in-law is involved in, but he didn't do that. And the prosecutors ended up withdrawing whatever he had been told was going to be his sweetheart deal. Cohen is not a good guess. We do know that on Monday of this week, Pecker, the former head of the National Enquirer, spoke. We do know that Cohen's former lawyer, Costello, spoke to the grand jury twice. Now, this becomes an interesting question because Costello apparently is a witness whose testimony helps President Trump. How can he speak when there was attorney-client privilege as Michael Cohen's lawyer? Well, Cohen signed a document that told Costello, that authorized Costello to go off and speak. Cohen, President Trump's former lawyer, says that he doesn't recall signing that, but he did. The fact that Michael Cohen, who is really the star witness, it's not Stormy Daniels, Michael Cohen, President Trump's former lawyer, the star witness, has already gone to prison, so anything he says is questionable because of who he is and what he's already been convicted of. And number two, his lawyer at the time, we're hearing the testimony that he gives, cuts against Michael Cohen, and he's not a convicted felon, is Costello. I don't have more to bring today on this subject. It is rattling news. It is bad news. It is a 7-year-old allegation of a violation of federal law. The Federal Election Commission chairman said he didn't think there was a violation. The Mueller report said they didn't think it was a violation. Cyrus Vance Jr., who was the immediate past Manhattan District Attorney, refused to bring the case. Alvin Bragg, when he took over as District Attorney, refused to bring the case. And now they brought it back out 7 years later. The statute of limitations, it's not a state case. All of this designed to embarrass Trump. I don't have anything else. Nobody has anything else. So we're going to get to the show. That's the terrible news for the day.
You've got the Michael Berry Show.
For years, I've told you we're not a breaking news show. Hannity is. And it's a very different show. He'll say, we are a breaking news show. And they will go into a breaking story as it's happened. We don't. And the reason for that, whether it's a shooting or a bomb blast or whatever, is things are happening in real time. And we are required to rely on primary reporting, which is often, in fact, arguably, usually wrong. If you just tuned into the show, news has broken just a few minutes ago that President Trump was indicted by the grand jury. The news broke at about 5:30 p.m. Eastern, so it's pretty fresh. To my knowledge, the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg has not issued a statement and is not responding to requests for statements. The Trump campaign or any relation to Trump is not speaking or issuing a statement. The court system has not issued a statement, but there is on reliable authority the belief that the grand jury voted to indict. Now, I know you know this, but in case someone doesn't, before a criminal trial and the steps for a criminal case can begin, a grand jury must first vote to indict or to acquit, or basically not indict. No bill. Actually, it's not to acquit. It's to no bill. It's been almost 30 years since I took criminal law. Cut me some slack. And I'm not going to lie to you. I thought it might happen, and it ramped up, and then they pulled back, and I thought, you know what? Bragg's not a complete idiot. He realizes this is a complete debacle, and he's not going to let this go forward. He's not going to be known as the guy who did this. Well, ego's a terrible thing. And Alvin Bragg got it in his head that I guess he couldn't stop the momentum of this freight train that's left the station. I truly believe Alvin Bragg will regret this for the rest of his career. Because now what he's done by wronging Trump like this is he has set off an entire army of people who are going to dig into everything Alvin Bragg has ever done. Every day you're going to find out, oh, well, did you know he did this? And did you know he did this? And there are consequences to acting in this manner as he has. And I think professionally, this will harm him. I think professionally this, he's not rumored to be the sharpest pencil in the pack. And he's not going to hold up well to this. He's not going to be the one that tries this case, to be clear. And that's typical. A district attorney is not usually the guy who tries the high-profile cases within his jurisdiction. You're going to have a prosecutor, usually their number two, who is the courtroom guru, who's going to be for murder cases and for white-collar fraud cases. The case, it is expected, will revolve around a payment made to Stormy Daniels. The charge has to be related to a violation of state law, which makes this very hard. New York really has no jurisdiction here. The federal election laws and federal tax laws relate are federal laws. State courts don't hear them. So the Mueller report had every opportunity to bring that case. The Southern District of New York U.S. attorney had every opportunity to bring that case. And that would have been the proper jurisdiction. And it isn't that they didn't think about it. They both devoted a lot of time to this. The Federal Election Commission chairman said he didn't believe there was a violation. Hillary Clinton's campaign gave money the reverse. They gave money to the campaign, paid a lawyer who then paid GPS Fusion for the Steele dossier, which was the fake dossier on Trump that made it seem like he was in the back pocket of the Russians. And they fined her last year. If you wanted to fine Trump for, hey, we believe this payment to Stormy Daniels a week before the campaign is really a campaign expenditure, fine. Fine the campaign. Okay. Tacky, but whatever. What we would call a ticky-tack foul this weekend in March Madness. Ticky-tack foul here. Here's a check. All right. Got it. to call this a campaign expense as opposed to an organizational expense would be to say that we don't want to hurt the campaign a week before the election, when you could make every argument that Trump is also the face of the Trump organization and we needed to protect the brand of our product, and our product is Donald Trump in his name. You don't have to like that. You don't have to think, well, it doesn't smell right. It has to do more than smelling right. We don't put someone on trial for a crime in such a squirrely case as this. We've never put a U.S. president on criminal trial before. Ever. And now we have. And now that has been broken. And it is my hope that every Democrat who has ever held that office will now be indicted somewhere in America. This is what you have to do. You have to give them back what they've done in such a way that it harms them so badly that they think twice about doing this again. The media loves this. And I'll be clear, it's great for talk radio. It's going to be great for television. Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, all of them. Every day will be an update. I've said for 8 years, since 2015, what's the media going to do when Trump is gone? Because nothing is as good for ratings as he is. When Zucker was head of CNN, he told their staff, no matter what we're covering, you cut to Trump because people want to watch Trump. It might be a grudge watch. It might be because they hate him. It might be because they love him. But here we go. I do not relish this. This is awful. This is horrible. This is where we are in America. This is right up there with some trans terrorist shooting up the church school. The only difference being, in this case, nobody's died. But this is wrong. It is evil. It is awful. And this will echo for a very long time. I've got this. You talking about the statement from Joe? Okay. There is a statement from President Trump referring to this as political persecution and election interference. We're not going to get a lot tonight. It's sort of like when we don't know the identity of the shooter, there's going to be a lot of talk about talk. We're not going to get a lot tonight. By tomorrow, the details are going to be rolling in. And by Monday, this thing will begin in earnest. I suspect we'll have an arraignment on Monday. And that's when this is going to start. One thing, President Trump's not going to take this lying down. As you might imagine, he's going to come out fighting, as well he should. So I think we are now going to get to the rest of the show, and here we go.
The Michael Berry Show continues.
President Trump has been indicted. The Manhattan grand jury did it. I hope Alvin Bragg is happy. If you just tuned in, the news coming down at about 5:30 Eastern today, 4:30 Central. No more details other than that. It is expected that we probably won't get any more details. They'll start leaking out tomorrow. But for now, we probably won't get any more details. And that's all we're going to know, is that they are going to indict President Trump. Or have actually indicted President Trump. They will not convict him. Make no mistake. They will not be able to convict him. And if by some stroke of luck they do, on appeal, this case will be thrown out. And the idea is to put him through a living hell. And what this will do, which they never understand this, what this will do is bolster his campaign. His campaign will absolutely, positively be stronger than ever. The people who kind of like Trump are going to see that this is the first time this has ever been done. A president, you've got the Clintons, you've got the Obamas, you've got Biden and his son and the criminal element. We're going to do the rest of the show because that's all we know at present. That's all anyone knows. But now you know, President Trump has been indicted. If you have Apple TV, I would commend to you a program called The Big Con, C-O-N-N. It's about a lawyer named Eric Kahn, who was a Social Security, he's actually an SSI lawyer in Eastern Kentucky. And he practiced in a court in West Virginia, just across the state border. And there was a judge named Judge Daugherty. And Judge Daugherty went to the lawyer and said, hey, you go sign up all these people for disability in poor, rural, eastern Kentucky. You bring them to my court, and I will approve them all. I'll say they're all disabled. And he did. 99.7% of the people, he said, were disabled. The average rate, somewhere between 30% and 50%, depending on the judge. And so Eric Kahn started making millions and millions and millions of dollars and sharing that with the judge who would approve all of these. You didn't have to be disabled. In fact, the doctor who was supposed to say you were disabled didn't even review your case. It was a bad deal. And what you see out of that one lawyer and judge alone is over $500 million. Now, you add this up. If everybody gets disability, which is SSI, part of the Social Security Fund, and the Social Security Department, once they found out about it, they never rewarded the whistleblowers. In fact, they made life hell for them. They never even really admitted they had made a mistake. We're going to have to do something about Social Security, and Joe Biden used to agree with that. So this next little segment we have is called Signs and Wonders. Joe Biden is now criticizing other people for saying the exact things he used to say.
It's all the damn money it done. Money and the drugs. It's just damn beyond everything. What's it mean? What's it leading to? You know, if you'd have told me 20 years ago, I'd see children walking the streets of our Texas towns with green hair, bones in their noses. I just flat out wouldn't have believed you.
Signs and wonders. But I think once you quit hearing sir and ma'am, the rest is soon to follow.
Oh, it's the tide. It's the dismal tide. It is not the one thing.
Not the one thing.
Signs and wonders. Sir and ma'am, the rest is soon to follow.
Signs and wonders.
Not the one thing.
It's the dismal tide.
The Biden 2024 playbook appears to be railing against Republicans over entitlements.
Some Republicans want Medicare and Social Security to sunset.
But a lot of Republicans, their dream is to cut Social Security and Medicare.
That's the Republican dream. I'm their nightmare.
MAGA Republicans are threatened to gut and eliminate these programs.
But CNN's K-File team has discovered that the president once held the positions that he is now ridiculing, like raising the retirement age. Here is then-Senator Biden in 1987.
The year 2010, we are going to change the retirement age for Social Security. You cannot retire at age 65. You have to be 65 years and 3 months old. In the year 2012, 65 years and 6 months. In the year, raise incrementally the retirement age till you reach a retirement age between 68 and 70.
CNN's Andrew Kaczynski leads up the K-File unit, and he's joining us live. So, Andrew, that clip was from 1987, but you all were able to uncover many more examples of President Biden, then Senator Biden, proposing changes to entitlement.
Yeah, that's right. So Biden is attacking, and the White House are attacking Republicans for positions that he once held on Social Security. We just heard that clip where he talked about wanting to raise the retirement age in the 1980s. That's something he said repeatedly, but it actually goes beyond that. Take, for instance, his attacks on Rick Scott and this sunset legislation. Now, Sunsetting basically means that a program will get authorized for something like 4 years, and then if it's not reauthorized, they don't fund it anymore. That's hence where the term sunset comes from. Now, Biden introduced a bill in 1975 that did the exact same thing. It sunset all federal legislation without exemptions for Social Security and Medicare. And what's interesting about this is Biden's bill to do this, this sunset legislation, was the first ever of its kind. We just saw on the screen where he was basically boasting about how he sort of almost invented this concept of sunsetting at the federal level. And what's interesting about his attacks now on Rick Scott and Republicans is we saw Rick Scott put an exemption specifically for entitlement programs into his bill. Biden himself actually did the same thing in 1978. He had another sunset bill that he signed on, and this one specifically also put in exemptions for Social Security and Medicare. But, you know, it also even goes beyond that. We've seen Biden over the course of his career talk about wanting to put, you know, Medicare or being open to putting Medicare, Social Security, things like that on the table in negotiations. Take a listen to this clip from 2005 where he talks about even possibly being open to benefit cuts.
Raising the cap, raising the retirement age for people who are now 30 years old, raising the tax on Social Security, cutting benefits. They're all things that have to be discussed, quite frankly.
All right, Andrew Kuczynski, thank you very much for all of that. I want to read the White House statement to you. President Biden has publicly pledged to veto any plan that cuts Social Security or Medicare benefits or raises taxes on Americans making less than $400,000 a year. That is his position today.
This is
the Michael Berry.
President Trump has been indicted. The Manhattan grand jury did it. I hope Alvin Bragg is happy. If you just tuned in, the news coming down at about 5:30 Eastern today, 4:30 Central. No more details other than that. It is expected that we probably won't get any more details. They'll start leaking out tomorrow. But for now, we probably won't get any more details. And that's all we're going to know is that they are going to indict President Trump. They will not convict him. Make no mistake. They will not be able to convict him. And if by some stroke of luck they do, on appeal, this case will be thrown out. And the idea is to put him through a living hell. And what this will do, which they never understand this, what this will do is bolster his campaign. His campaign will absolutely, positively be stronger than ever. The people who kind of like Trump are going to see that this is the first time this has ever been done. A president, you've got the Clintons, you've got the Obamas, you've got Biden and his son and the criminal element. We're going to do the rest of the show because that's all we know at present. That's all anyone knows. But now you know, President Trump has been indicted. Last week, President Trump hosted a dinner for Cynthia Hughes and the families of January 6th prisoners. Cynthia Hughes is our guest. Cynthia, I want to get right to it. Due process denied in what way? How have the January 6th prisoners been denied due process?
First of all, thank you so much for having me and allowing me to talk on this topic. In this country, you're really not supposed to be held more than about 75 days, I think it is. But don't quote me on that. Something has to have transpired. Either you're going to go to trial, you've taken a plea deal, you have a trial date set, and we're still seeing people that are still sitting in what we call pretrial detention more than 2 years later. You have denied them their due process in that, and that's just one regard, denying them their right to call their attorney, another way to deny their due process, denying them their right to freedom of speech, their right to religion. They were denied every constitutional right you could think of during the first year and a half that they were sitting in jail. And not just in D.C., all of these jails. We still have guys that are sitting in a Virginia jail that are still in true solitary confinement right now. D.C. has improved in the terms of There's visits now with the families, easier access to your lawyer. You can get a haircut, I think. You can get, you know, visits with friends, and you're not in solitary confinement anymore. But let's be honest. I mean, the damage is done. What the D.C. jail did to these Americans, it's going to live with them forever.
And where do we go from here? I noticed they just released the shaman who was supposed to get 42 months, and just out of nowhere, he was released. But a lot of these people, these are not people of means. These are working class people. They're retirees. They're students. This is really, really a disturbing deal.
Well, you know, in the case of Jacob Chansley, his first attorney was, well, I think he did more harm to Jake than he did good for him. And that's why he got fired. And Bill Shipley was brought on to his case. And Bill did a great job for Jake Chansley. But a lot of people are going to get caught up today in the fact that Jake was released, and they're going to say it was because of the Tucker footage, but it was not because of the Tucker footage. I've spoken to Bill, and Bill has told me, you know, Jake's release is because, and I knew this a few days ago, you know, is because of the First Step Act, you know, nonviolent charges, no criminal history, you know, a good prisoner. I hate to put it that way. And he went through his programs, and he took advantage of every program he could while he was incarcerated. And there falls, you know, the early release. The same thing is going to happen for my nephew. He's still behind bars. He's been in jail since January of 2021, just like Jake. He will likely get out in a few months. His release date is not for another year and a half. So that's the purpose of the First Step Act. I mean, that's the only saving grace for anybody that is not, you know, charged with a violent, you know, crime in connection with January 6th. But I will tell you, somebody sent me a video today, an article on Politico. I'll be happy to text it to you if you'd like to see it. There was a juror that was interviewed. I can't remember the name of the gentleman, somebody Lamb or something, that interviewed this woman. She was a juror on the recent Oathkeeper trial. Another case that Bill Shipley, another trial that Bill Shipley was involved in. And he had a very good win in that case as well on his client. This woman literally had the gall to say that jurors in D.C. either come on to these trials with their mind made up and it's not going to matter what they hear because they're going to give a guilty verdict, period. Or she said her and another juror, specifically a lawyer that was a juror on this case, they were able to sway the other jurors to, you know, go the way that they were leaning. And everybody, with the exception of Bill's client, you know, everybody was found guilty, you know, sedition, seditious conspiracy. I mean, it was an absolute you-know-what show in that trial. But when you think about what this juror said, I mean, every single one of these trials should be declared a mistrial.
Right.
This, you know, we've been seeing lawyers file change of venue motions that have been denied every time, every turn. In every single, you know, case that change of venue has been filed, this, if there's never a question, here it is, right? Every change of venue motion should be granted. And every case that has been, you know, resulted in a guilty verdict, it should be overturned immediately based on this woman's comments.
That and many other things. But that is at the very core. You know, you learn about the Brady Rule in law school. Every baby lawyer knows about it. It's a case out of Maryland, but it's understood that the prosecution has to hand over exculpatory evidence to the defense. They can't just hold on to things that come into their possession. If you've got information, evidence that will help the defense in proving their innocence, you have to hand that over.
You're right. You're right. And, you know, let's talk about Julian Cater. The first night that Tucker aired the little bit of footage that he did, I mean, I wish he would have aired more, but the first night that he was airing footage, it showed Officer Sicknick walking around in the Capitol, doing his, you know, duties, working, you know, interacting with people that were inside the Capitol. And here you have Julian Cater, who just got sentenced to 80 months in prison. They had to hand, you know, serve somebody up on a silver platter to the Sicknick family. I mean, the day of Julian's sentencing, I mean, it was an absolute circus in that courtroom. You had over, it really, really was. I was with Julian's family that day. I've gotten very close with Julian's family. His father is a wonderful man, and they couldn't even go to the sentencing. They could not even put their faces inside that courtroom because it was that much of a circus act.
That's imagine that. Your loved one is facing essentially the rest of their life in prison, and you can't be there. FBI Director Christopher Wray was asked if there were FBI agents embedded among the protesters who very well could have been provoking all of this, and he refused to answer. How do you refuse to answer? That basically is the answer. You're not a criminal defendant. You're the government. You have to tell us whether you were doing that or not. The book is Due Process Denied: The Detained, The Families, The Fallout.
It's that time. Lock and load. The Michael Vary Show is on the air.
President Trump has been indicted. The Manhattan grand jury did it. I hope Alvin Bragg is happy. If you just tuned in, the news coming down at about 5:30 Eastern today. No more details other than that. But now you know, President Trump has been indicted. Empowering voters to take back our government. Empowering employees to fight back against stupid corporate policies. Empowering consumers to support businesses owned with people by people that share your values. This is how we're going to win back our country. It's not going to be easy. It didn't happen overnight. It's going to require a lot of fighting. And it's never going to look like we're going to win until we do. And the minute we win, we're going to have to keep winning. Because the left won't stop. It's a religion for them. Understand that. So a couple of years ago, a parent who was interested in changing his school, who I knew as a dad from Little League, came to me. And he was going to run for the school board. And I said, you're the kind of guy that should win but won't win. Because good people don't win. I don't think you got the fire in the belly. I don't think you're mean enough. By golly, he did, and he won, and dadgummit, he's doing a great job. We spoke to him this morning. I'm going to share some of the things he shared about what their school district is doing. The school district decided, you know what? We're not going to let the teachers or the administrators read the books and decide what's going to be on the shelves of the library. We, the board, are going to do it. I want you to hear this story. The big story is Spring Branch ISD school board members voted 4-3 on Monday to drop multiple points of review from its book review, according to a report published Monday by ABC 13's Brianna Connor. And it says that the vote removes the first two of three layers from the district's review process, maintaining only the final checkpoint in which the board members will handle it. As I understand it, the school board said, guess what? We're not leaving it to administrators anymore to review the books to see what is sexually explicit and what is, we'll handle it ourselves. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, and honest, I mean, it's that, and it's also to help our administration. You know, we passed a policy in October that sort of revamped our process for challenges to library materials because of all the issues we've been made aware of. And that process included a three-level review, the first of which triggers a review of a committee of at least six people that includes a lot of our employees in the district. And within 72 hours of passing that policy, we had 25 different people challenge elementary-aged books for, you can't make this stuff up, but books like Smile. And the reason for having it removed is that kids that wear braces shouldn't be ashamed. Or a book called Waiting is Not Easy. There's a character that's an elephant that's incredibly impatient, and speaking animals generally confuse people. Diary of a Wimpy Kid. It discriminates against kids who aren't athletic and should be removed for all readers that are not at least 18 years old. So these books were filed to clog up legitimate sure. system that we attempted sure. to set up to have it reviewed. And, you know, we have meetings with the administration and how are things going, and we do have some very legitimate books that are under consideration, and these are in front of those, and they trigger this process. And so that is ultimately what the board decided to do Monday was we're going to take these on ourselves. We signed up to do this. We created the policy. The policy is the board's. We are the third level of appeal or in the final decision maker, so we're ready to take those decisions on ourselves and lift that burden from the administration and help them with these childish ones. I actually hope that some of these people will come in public and make these arguments
yeah.
you know, as to why it looks like the couch potato ought to be removed. But then also we'll take on some of the more serious, you know, sexually explicit material that we found in our libraries and take it head on.
I want to give me just a moment, and then I'm going to ask you a question. But I want our listeners to understand, because you're going to see Texas Monthly, which has weighed into this pretty heavily, and you're going to see some folks say that these are book censors. This is a sort of Ray Bradbury book burning. This is censorship. These are book banners. These are, you know, somehow the Taliban. These are awful people. So there's a woman named Denise Bell, and she was one of the speakers at the school board meeting. And she ran out of time, but she wrote out her comments. She has four children in the district. Let's just say she's invested. And she was speaking, and she was talking about a book called Looking for Alaska by John Green. And she submitted her challenge earlier that she wanted a response. And she was told by the district, this is for for children as young as 14, this book has fabulous vocabulary. The content is not meant to be erotic, as in arousing sexual desire. It's not graphic. So she pulled out some sections of the book, and I'm going to read them to you, but I can't use all the words. This is for children as young as 14. Yeah. Just as the Bradys were getting locked in jail, Laura randomly asked me, have you ever gotten a BJ? Now, technically, I can say what BJ stands for, but I'm not going to. Further down. I think I want to, she said. These are two teenagers. These are two kids talking to each other. And we kissed a little. And then with me sitting watching the Brady Bunch, watching Marsha, up to her Brady antics, Laura unbuttoned my pants and pulled my boxers down a little and pulled out my penis. Wow, she said. What? I said. She looked up at me and didn't move, but her face nanometers away from my penis. It's weird. What do you mean weird? I asked. Just big, I guess. I could live with that kind of weird. And then she wrapped her head around it and put it in her mouth. And then we go down to how she puts it in her mouth. And then he refers to her laying there stock still with my penis in her mouth. And then she says, should I do something? Everything I'd learned from watching porn with Alaska suddenly exited my brain. I thought maybe she should move her head up and down. But would that choke her? So I just stayed quiet. Should I, like, bite? Don't bite, I said. I mean, I don't think. I don't know. I don't think that'll feel good. So they go back and forth. So we went to her room and asked Alaska. She laughed and laughed. Sitting on her bed, she laughed until she cried. She walked into the bathroom, returned with a tube of toothpaste, and showed us in detail. Never have I so wanted to be crest complete. I don't think any administrator at the school in good faith could say, Yeah, it's great vocabulary. There's nothing erotic or intended to arouse gratification or inappropriate for a 12, 13, or 14-year-old.
Yeah. I commend you for actually reading it on the air, because the Chronicle and Channel 13 can, you know, shoot arrows at us all they want, but they won't read that on air.
No, and that's just it. I want it to be uncomfortable. I want people to have to squirm, and then you go, all right, now you're sitting in class. Now your kid, 13 years old, your little girl is sitting in class, and the teacher says, let's read this out loud, and they start reading about penises and oral pleasure.
Initially, I mentioned those 25 books that have been filed that I consider to be quite frivolous. We'll take care of those first, perhaps in an afternoon or two preceding a board meeting or on a Friday at some point, and then we'll have to tackle, you know, some of the longer. I mean, some of these books are very long, you know. We'll read them and take those reviews seriously, and then, you know, render a judgment. You know, the key for those heavier material like you read, I mean, the key deciding point for us is on educational suitability. And that phrase is, you know, somewhat vague, but it's actually somewhat brilliant in that it doesn't, you know, we get criticized, oh, well, you're not a librarian, you're not an expert, this and that. But when you read something like you read on the air, and then I take a phrase like, is that educationally suitable for my 12-year-old, my 14-year-old, my 6-year-old? Absolutely not. It doesn't take anything but common sense to make those decisions. And we plan, you know, to exercise, you know, that power that we've been given in this position. We're going to take care of it.
You've got the Michael Berry.
President Trump has been indicted. The Manhattan grand jury did it. I hope Alvin Bragg is happy. If you just tuned in, the news coming down at about 5:30 Eastern today, 4:30 Central. No more details other than that. We're going to do the rest of the show because that's all we know at present. That's all anyone knows. But now you know. President Trump has been indicted. Spoke this morning to Chris Ernest, who's the president of the Spring Branch Independent School District in Houston. And this could be your school district. You could run. You could win. You could take back your school. And the issue here is the school board decided, you know what? They found these books that are very, very inappropriate. References to sexual organs, to all sorts of sexual acts and by teenagers or by kids on other kids. And it's very disturbing that they're trying to stick this in front of kids. It's disturbing. And these parents on the school board said, we're going to step in and we're going to stop it. We're going to review the books that go on the shelves of the school. We're not going to allow this any longer. It's not going to be allowed to continue. I want you to listen to, we made a little montage of some of the highlights of our interview. You can hear it on the podcast if you go back to this morning's show. But I want you to understand, and then we're also going to later in the show talk about homeschooling. I want you to understand that you can't just get mad any longer. You got to do something. You got to put yourself in harm's way. You've got to step up and speak out. If not you, then who? You can't wait on someone else to solve your problem any longer. Hats off to Chris Ernest, a lawyer by day who said, you know what? I got five kids in this school district. I got to do something. It strikes me that people want to pretend it's sort of this relativism that you can't be in the position of deciding what is and isn't appropriate. But we do this all day, every day.
Tell
our daughter, that skirt's too high. Why do you say it's too high? Because I can see your panties under it when you're walking. Well, how long does it need to be? I don't know, but that's not long enough. These are decisions exactly. That parents and a community can agree upon. Now, maybe not 100% consensus, but I think what I read would be out of bounds. And it strikes me that the most out of bounds can be removed from the classroom. Have y'all heard from teachers or other administrators with whom you say, I think we may have a fundamental disagreement as to what is appropriate here?
Generally, no. They may be out there, but I can't say that I've had teachers contact me that aren't, supporting the direction that we're headed. People like to always say, teachers are going to flee our district and this and that because we're, it's viewpoint discrimination or whatever the argument might be. But the fact is we have a district our size. We always have openings, but we have half of the openings that we typically have this time of year. So this argument that people are going to flee and they won't want to work in our district and this and that is turning out to be false. Michael, what he read, that's just so obvious. Like, that's not a difficult decision to make. People get confused. We're talking about school libraries. We're not talking about the public library, that the city provides. And there's a difference. There's a big difference. What is educationally suitable? What is age appropriate? What sort of content are we as a school district and a board going to put in front of our children? What's appropriate?
The district's vote follows its decision last fall to ban The Breakaways, a graphic novel about a group of eighth grade soccer players that features a transgender character. Tell me about that book.
The Breakaways, the challenge with that book is, it appears to be an innocent children's book on a girls' soccer team. And it's one of these graphic novels, and by graphic, I mean it's like a 250-page comic book, and that's all the rage these days. But the first 100 pages are, simply a book about a girls' soccer team, and then the next thing you know, you flip a few pages, and then they're in bed together wondering whether or not, they're homosexual and should we kiss and all this. And it's, and that's in elementary schools. It's just content that's inappropriate at that level. And you get into a bigger problem. It's easy to talk about, specific schools, specific libraries, bad actors within a specific school. But the problem, Michael, with like that book in particular is Scholastic and these book companies and review companies are pushing this trash down on the schools, and they get these ridiculously rave reviews about what great content this is, and this is a book you have to have in your elementary school library, and it's featured at the book fairs, and that's how it innocently ends up in a kid's hands, and the next thing you know, you've got a parent calling you like, what the heck is this material that you're providing to my kid? And so we're really having to rethink the whole system. It's not just about the book challenges and what's boiling up to the board. It's also about book orders.
Chris, let me ask you this. Is the problem worse than you expected when you decided to run?
Oh, this is not on my radar. No, look, I love our school district. We do a lot of great things for, you know, good teachers and good administrators are some of the hardest working people that I've met in my entire life. So over the course of the last 2 years, I think one of my takeaways is a good administrator and a good teacher is worth their weight in gold. And those people work harder than anyone I've ever been around in my entire life.
It's almost never heterosexual relationships or behavior. It seems to be that it's important that these be sexual themes and that they either be transgender or homosexual in nature. Is that, from your experience, is that true or no?
Yeah, no, I definitely think that's true. I've thought about that issue a little bit, and I think part of the reason for that is if I'm going to write a book about a homosexual character and you're going to know that they're a homosexual character, I have to include that in the book, right? And so you have, you know, them exploring, you know, who they are and they come to some conclusion, but you have to describe that if the book is going to be about, you know, if your character is going to be LGBTQ. I mean, so it's got to be included. So that's why I feel like they're more prone to having this type of material in the book. By definition, you have to talk about it.
And these are books that are assigned for class or books that are on the shelves at the school library?
Right now, we're dealing with libraries. So the books that are challenged right now, you know, are in one or more libraries throughout the district. Our next Herculean task next school year will be to go through a similar process with instructional material, which is in the classroom. So we took on the libraries first, trying to get that cleaned up. It's been for me, it's been a 2-year process. I feel like we're now making progress. This will help, you know, our latest action will help that. And then next is taking on the instructional material in the classroom. And that will be handled under a separate policy. But we wanted to get the libraries in a comfortable position and then move on to the next and not try to take too much on. But you know, as I said, are we making a difference? Yeah, we are. It takes a little time, unfortunately, but that's the plan, is libraries first, instructional classroom material next. Because the other thing that I learned in the last, you know, year and a half or so is that it's not just libraries. You know, your average English language arts class in middle school has a library of its own of 700 to 800 books, and there's been some questionable material identified by teachers and parents and others, you know, within those collections, and those are provided by publishers. And you know, as I said, you place an order with Scholastic for 100 books and they throw in 10 freebies, and I bet you a lot of money in those 10 freebies, there's going to be some questionable material. So they just, it's really, I mean, it is, they're pushing to include that in our instructional and library materials. I mean, we've documented where we found some of that material in books that the district did not actually order. They were just placed in the box.
It sure does seem there is a concerted, coordinated, rather sophisticated effort to get traditionally age-inappropriate materials in front of children, the younger the better, that are cringeworthy were they to be read at a board meeting or over the air. And it's not accidental. These books don't just have... We're not talking about Old Yeller or Sounder here. We're talking about books with a very pointed theme, as if there is an agenda to get this in front of kids, and it's too much for a young child to process, period. And we don't allow them to come in and put tattoos on. We don't allow them to do these sorts of things. Why on earth would we allow these books, our children, to be exposed to these books? We know that the mind is not ready for that. We wouldn't allow drugs in the school by the same token.
We have movie ratings for the same reason.
Very well said. Very well said.
The Michael Berry Show.
He's just perfect.
They will not convict him. Make no mistake. They will not be able to convict him. And if by some stroke of luck they do, on appeal, this case will be thrown out. And the idea is to put him through a living hell. We're going to do the rest of the show because that's all we know at present. That's all anyone knows. But now you know, President Trump has been indicted. This entire hour, we are focused on education, whether taking over your local school board or homeschooling your own child. We spoke to a school board president earlier in the hour that's doing some great things. And we're speaking now to a woman who created, who left her day job and created Texas Homeschool Educators. There is someone in your state that can help you. We'll continue this conversation because more and more of you are wanting to homeschool, and you should. Jube, J-U-B-E, Jube Dankworth is the president and CEO of Texas Home Educators, an organization that services families statewide in the state of Texas and teaches parents where to begin with homeschooling. Now, I know over half of you are outside the state of Texas, and you're saying, yeah, but what about me? There are lots of resources out there. I want you to pay attention to the resources that are available, because wherever you are, there are people who can help you with this. Jube, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
So how did you, let's start with how you got involved with the homeschooling movement at all.
I was managing a law firm, and they were destroying my child. So I realized that I needed to find something else, and met a homeschooler in the church, and we started talking. And back then, it was illegal in Texas, and you could be arrested. So, you know, I started studying, reading books. There were some radio shows that were talking about it, and so we, you know, pulled our child out and started teaching her. I quit my job and came home.
I have known of a number of parents who did exactly what you just did. Let's leave aside the personal and professional cost to that. Let's just focus first on the challenges faced by the uncertainty. You are walking in the dark. Let's walk through those first stages for a parent that begins the homeschooling process.
Well, in today's world, the process is, of course, to withdraw your child. I suggest that people, we have a Start Here page on our website, texashomeeducators.org, and it has a flow chart and lots of resources for parents who are starting. We also have free lesson plans on there, so they can kind of look at lesson plans. We suggest that they connect with homeschoolers online. Most of the homeschoolers are now on Facebook, so they can input the name of their town and put homeschool, and there will be several groups there. They can ask questions and find out about all of the wonderful events that are happening in all the states across the nation. So they can, you know, join people and get there. We have all of the same events, so to speak, as public school. The kids do Civil Air Patrol 4-H, they do scouts, they do, we have science fairs, we have all the sports, football, cheer, all of that, with graduation proms. So it's not like if you step out into homeschooling, you're going to miss out on, you know, the things that we cherish about the public school.
And then go ahead.
It depends on which state they're in. In Texas, we do not have to report. We withdraw our children, and then we homeschool them. In other states, you have to register. You have to turn in reports. You have, in Florida, you even have to let a teacher come in and evaluate your children. So it depends on what state you're in. That's why I suggest people go to their state organization, and they can find that at hslda.org.
H-S-L-D-A?
H-L...
Homeschool.
Homeschool Legal Defense Organization.
Okay, Homeschool Legal Defense Organization. Oh, H-S-L-D-A. Okay. So let's talk about the first day. How do you, you know, do you set up in your kitchen and go, all right, we're, kiddo, we're going to get through this together. Mom's not perfect at this, but we're going to do this.
No. The first day, the first week, the first month, I suggest, just like they do in officer training school, you set up the routine. You set up, okay, we're going to get up, fix our beds or not, have breakfast, read some books. And again, it depends on what age you're talking about, if you're talking elementary or teens. And you get used to being at home. We used to have, our house was a dinner bed place. Everything else was done outside the home. And so we had to get used to being at home. And, you know, that is actually the hardest part of homeschooling, is you have to do 21 meals at home. And so,
you know what's interesting, Jube? I've talked to a lot of homeschool resources over the years, and that has never come up. And you're right. That's the difference between the weekend and the weekday for us. I mean, all of a sudden, we've got meals, we've got food, we've got, you know, those sorts of that's a pedestrian, mundane issue, but it's real, especially when the kid's hungry.
That's it, and your grocery bill will go up. But no, sometimes it goes down, but usually depending on how much you go out to eat. But it's getting used to it, because, like, I came home from working full-time, and it was like, okay, what do I do? And it was this was the shock that everybody on COVID had, was they were used to being out, and now everybody was in. So when you're homeschooling and you're at home with the kids, it's different. But we do have a page on deschooling, which is where the kids learn. You let the kids get bored enough, especially at the beginning, let them detox from what they have experienced in public school. And then eventually they get that love of learning again, which was the first thing school drills out of all the children. There is no love of learning. You know, they've made tests, and, you know, your four-year-old will ask you 935 questions a day. Your eight-year-old will not. Well, what happens between four and eight? Well, they go to school. And so you want that child to get that love of learning again and knowing that they can accomplish it, then they can do things, and they are good people. So that's why we suggest a season of deschooling. And then you, why this is happening, the mom can have a chance to go to some resources that will help her decide, what is my child's learning style? I had different learning styles. I had an auditory, I had a visual, I had a kinetic. So you learn to get the curriculum or get the program or whatever you're using. There's so much variety now that you can teach to their style, and they will absorb what they're going on. The first child I pulled had ADHD, but back then girls didn't have that. So I'm reading on the comfy couch, and she's doing somersaults on the floor. We finish the story. She can stand up and tell me exactly what I said. You know, but she was being reprimanded constantly at school.
The Michael Berry Show. He's just...
President Trump has been indicted. The Manhattan grand jury did it. I hope Alvin Bragg is happy. If you just tuned in, the news coming down at about 5:30 Eastern today, 4:30 Central. No more details other than that. It is expected that we probably won't get any more details. They'll start leaking out tomorrow. But for now, we probably won't get any more details. And that's all we're going to know, is that they are going to indict President Trump. Or have actually indicted President Trump. We're going to do the rest of the show, because that's all we know at present. That's all anyone knows. But now you know, President Trump has been indicted. Jube Dankworth is our guest. She is the president and CEO of Texas Home Educators. You can find their organization or one like it in your state if you are thinking of homeschooling.
Thank you, Michael. The Eagle Mountain ISD got rid of all the ADD kids in their school by having recess in the morning, at lunch, and afternoon. And so the kids could go out play, and then they could sit and study. And It's been real interesting to see, because that's what we had back in the old days in the last century. The kids need to be kids. Kids have not evolved. They're still kids. And so by doing the things that have been done for thousands of years, your child can learn and grow and learn, and you can teach to their passion. You know, we've had kids in homeschooling that are going to law school at 16, you know, because they were bored. And I remember my, I had one that was a very much a visual. She was reading at 3 and 4, but I had to put her into public school. And so she came home from second grade and she goes, "Mother, they're letting me read." And she was so excited because they finally allowed her to do what she had been doing since she was 3 and 4. So the kids, but anyway, so basically that's what you do. You get used to being at home. Then you add things, reading, writing, math, you know, and so forth. And then the sciences and all of that. There's lots of support, particularly here in Texas. We have 500,000 homeschoolers. We've got 16 to 20 football teams, baseball. We just had the national basketball tournament, and we're going to be having proms and graduations.
You know what's interesting, Jude, about this? I want to cut you off because I think this is one of the things that scares people. I hear this, is they're scared to homeschool because their kid is in extracurricular activities. My Crockett is on the track team at his school, and he was just at a track meet that, for probably 3 of the last 4 weeks of track meets that he's been in, one of the teams was a homeschool team. And we've played homeschool teams in football. We've played homeschool teams in all that. We've been invited to homeschool graduations. We've heard about homeschool proms. So the experiences that are part of our culture, the sort of rites of passage, are being replicated so that the kid doesn't feel that they're not getting the same experience of going to the school. So you get all the upside with none of the downside. Jude, give me a list of, and kind of what comes up the most, what are the questions that parents have? What is the low-hanging fruit that every parent has?
The first thing they ask is, what curriculum do I use? Because they have a public school mindset. All of us come out with that because that's what we were trained to. We try to explain to them unschooling, Charlotte Mason, Montessori, Matthew C., or just the various curriculum styles out there. That's why we talk learning styles. That's why we talk about methods, and we talk about more than what is a public school, which is only one way to teach. There's so many other ways to teach. So after that, of course, they're wanting to get together, and that was the fun of COVID, was the homeschool moms were going just as crazy as the public school moms, because there were no libraries, there were no park days, all of our events got canceled. I was at a conference in Fort Worth when the city came in and said, "We're closing the convention in 4 hours." And so we had no place to take our kids, and that was the whole thing, was we are very active in the community. A lot of the kids doing service things, or they're starting their own businesses. There's even there's trades that have come to me in just in the last week that want to come and teach the kids how to, shoe horses and do welding and all of that stuff. So, like I said, the when my dad graduated high school 100 years ago, or almost that long, you graduated in 10th grade. And they added 2 years because of the Depression, so that the married man can work. They added, Clinton wanted to add community college as free and so forth, so they would add another 2 years. We extended insurance to 26, but in the old days, when you're 16 to 18, and I know that's very strong in the Hispanic community, you were ready to be an adult. You were ready to, get married and start your family and get your job, or get your job and then start your family is the better thing. But it's just, we help the moms with all of that. The other thing we do is a lot of the community now is online, and so on Facebook groups, we answer all the questions. We have lots of great, I love the Gen X moms. They are fierce, and they're giving advice to the millennials now that are bringing in their kids. And it's just awesome to see this continue on through the generations.
I thank you for doing this. You can find them online, texashomeeducators.org, texashomeeducators.org. And wherever you are in the sound of my voice, whatever state that may be, just go online and start looking. There are resources in every state for homeschooling that will be glad to help you. They lay it out. They have checklists on how to get started, how to comply with the law. They're helping you do this. You can do this. It's like starting a business. You can do this, and it will be rewarding. And if you can't find something for your state, there are national sites related to this. If you're not willing to spend the time looking online for the resources for how to do this, then no, homeschooling is not for you, because you're also not willing to prepare a curriculum. You're not willing to prepare for class. You're not willing. Homeschooling does not just mean keeping your kid out of the public school. Homeschooling means getting up and bringing a vitality to the lesson and teaching your child. You're already teaching your child. When your child reacts to what you tell them to do, when your child gets in an argument, when your child doesn't clean their room, you're teaching your child all day, every day. You're just adding to that, that you're teaching them a course curriculum that they would have otherwise been supposed to learn in the public school, and now you don't think they're going to learn under the atmosphere that you would have preferred. This is a serious issue. It's a growing issue. It's an important issue, and I file it under the umbrella of more and more American taxpayers, citizens, saying, I can't wait around on the state to solve my problem. I've got to solve my problem myself.
If you like the Michael Berry Show and podcast, please tell one friend. And if you're so inclined, write a nice review of our podcast. Comments, suggestions, questions, and interest in being a corporate sponsor and partner can be communicated directly to the show at our email address, michael@michaelberryshow.com, or simply by clicking on our website, michaelberryshow.com. The Michael Berry Show and podcast is produced by Ramon Robles, the King of Ding. Executive producer is Chad Nakanishi. Brad Gloria is the Baron of Booking for guests and provides voices. Jim Mudd is the creative director. Script writer, parody producer, and Lord of Laughter is Kenny Webster Jr., a.k.a. Producer Kenny. Voices, jingles, tomfoolery, and shenanigans are provided by Chance McLean. Director of Research is Sandy Peterson. Listener and superfan contributions are appreciated and often incorporated into our production. Where possible, we give credit. Where not, we take all the credit for ourselves. God bless the memory of Rush Limbaugh. Long live Elvis. Be a simple man, like Lynyrd Skynyrd told you, and God bless America. Finally, if you know a veteran suffering from PTSD, call Camp Hope at 877-717-PTSD, and a combat veteran will answer the phone to provide free counseling.